evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. I'm your host, John Tanza, coming to you live from Washington. Here are some of the top stories making news across Sudan and South Sudan this Monday, October 21st, 2024. Two Sudanese nationals are behind cyber attacks in the United States.
Looking at it vis-a-vis the level of unemployment, which is also very high, this alone puts them into a situation of engaging in hacking activities.
And a community in Bira Payam of Eastern Equatorial State signed a petition calling for the removal of their representative at the National Assembly in Juba.
We, as the Ketebo community, from effect of 17th of October 2024, have passed a vote of no confidence in Honorable Martin Odualo, who has been our Member of Parliament since 2005.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Eastern Equatorial State Kidiobo community in Bira Payam, Ikotos County, are calling for a vote of confidence to the Member of Parliament representing them at the National Legislative Assembly. The community say the Member of Parliament, Martin Odua, has not been representing their community well. Community members from Bira and Losite say they live in fear because their land has been demarcated for game park and their leader is doing nothing about it. They also say he has instigated conflict among community members. For VOA News, Kaltuma Vanessa reports from Torit.
The letter of non-confidence from Kitebu community came with 409 signatories. Kitebu is one of the 16 communities represented by Martin Odwar in the National Assembly. Charles Onen Lokwaru, the chairperson and coordinator for Kitebu Community Development, says residents lack basic services such as roads connecting the village to the state center and health services. He also says the community was not consulted on a project that took some of its land for a game park.
I would then continue to say, we as the Kitebu community, from effect of 17th of October 2024, have passed a vote of no confidence in Honorable Martin Odualo, who has been our Member of Parliament since 2005. But he has never given us any hope, has never served us as a leader. He has never brought any change positively to our community. And we have never seen anything good in his leadership.
Odwar says he represents more than just Kitebu community and their signatories are not enough to remove him from his seat in Parliament.
My constituency ranges from Lowoi up to Bira, the border with Uganda. Within this area, there are Lokwaya, a community, there are Wario as a community, there are Imotong as a community, there are Lotuko as a community, there are Logir as a community, there are Dongoton as a community, there are Loruama and Ketebo. All these are communities. But you, as a small community, 400 presumed to be signatures, if it were signed by the people, can you be able to remove now a member of parliament who has almost all these communities?
Silvio Zero, a member of SPLM loyal to President Salva Kiir, says since Bira is just a small part of Odwar's constituency, Kitebu must consult all the communities in the constituency for the party to dismiss him.
When we come to dismissing also a member of the constituency and that the party can accept, is when the people of that particular constituency sit together and deliberated on the failures of their MP, not just a small part of it, but the whole constituency, is when the party will accept, because it reflects all the geographical corners.
Odwar says he has been working hand in hand with his community, and he says the problem arose because he has declared his interest to stand for governor in 2026 election. For VOA News, I am Kaltuma Vanessa, reporting from Eastern Equatorial State Capital, Torit.
From matters of politics, we go to education, where officials in South Sudan say they are making significant strides to address the gender gap in education by reintegrating teenage mothers into schools. A new initiative aims to empower girls whose education was interrupted by early childbirth. Sheila Pony reports from Juba.
This is a very serious issue that the state as the country calls us Sudan should pay attention to, because it mostly disadvantages women and young girls.
That was Jua Nyumnek Daniel, a South Sudanese lawmaker, talking about the alarming rates of early and forced marriage among teenage girls in South Sudan. Early marriage is still common in many communities in South Sudan. Girls are often married off to secure economic stability for their families, a practice that not only limits their potential by denying their right to education, but also perpetuates cycles of poverty. Fatima, not her real name, was in her final year of primary school when she was forced into marriage. Her family cited financial struggles as the reason for the early marriage, a move that nearly ended her education.
I was forced by my parents to get married. That's why I first dropped out of school.
Fatima's story mirrors that of Naya, not her real name, who had her first child during her final year of high school. Her parents saw her pregnancy as the end of her education. Naya, like many young mothers in South Sudan, faced significant challenges after becoming pregnant during her final year of high school. With her parents withdrawing their support, she struggled to care for herself and her child. Determined to continue education, she returned to school 6 months after giving birth, defying societal expectations. Now, she is pursuing a degree in business administration at St. John Catholic University in Yambio.
Naya said that when she conceived, she never got the support that she used to get from her parents, and that now she struggles to provide for myself and for my child.
For Nelly, not her real name, her parents saw her marriage as an opportunity for economic gain. A local man promised her parents tens of cows and millions of South Sudanese pounds as dowry, leading them to push her into marriage. However, Nelly had her own dreams. She agreed to marry a man of her choosing, with the condition that he would allow her to go back to school.
I got a man because my parents were not paying me to school. Then he said that I should first give birth to him, then he would pay me to school. That's what made me to get pregnant. Then I dropped even from school. Then now he has accepted to be paying me to school.
Jewel Daniel, the lawmaker, says addressing early enforced marriage in South Sudan requires a concerted effort to challenge deep-seated cultural practices.
It is hard to eliminate or deal with or even to minimize because of cultural aspect. It is seen as a value of the society rather than the vice. Being seen as something positive, people always resist in continuing with the practice. They cannot abandon it easily, and it needs a deep-rooted government policy to uproot it, so that you need a government policy to make sure that this kind of practice, like forced marriage, early marriage, and child marriage, are eliminated.
In communities where education for girls is not a priority, attitudes are slowly changing, thanks to grassroots campaigns by international organizations. These efforts are reshaping cultural perceptions and highlighting the value of educating girls. Now back in school, Fatima encourages parents to reconsider early marriage and prioritize education for their children, especially girls.
I would not like most especially my girl children to pass through the same life that I have passed through, not only girls, because also my boys. I'll give them equal rights of going to school in the best schools, and also give them words of advice, encourage.
The Ministry of General Education and Instruction in South Sudan has been working
to address the issue of school dropouts. According to the ministry, over 70% of children, more than 2.8 million, are out of school, with conflict, displacement, and early marriage being major reasons for the high dropout rates. International organizations like Save the Children play a crucial role in supporting girls' education, especially for young mothers like Fatima and Naya. Isaac Otieno, education technical specialist at Save the Children International in Juba, explains the organization's effort.
Save the Children has been very deliberate in supporting girls in school. We are currently investing a lot in supporting the reintegration of girls who got pregnant and dropped out of school. So we are referring to them as young mothers. And supporting these young mothers, we are doing it through a program called Multi-Year Resilience Program, which is funded by Education Cannot Wait. And so we support them in getting few things like the school uniforms, the scholastic materials, everything that they could potentially be able to need to embark back to school.
Reintegrating young mothers into schools is not just about providing an education. It's about reshaping their futures and breaking down barriers. South Sudan's effort to tackle child marriage and improve access to education for girls are vital steps in creating a brighter future for its children. Sheila Aponi for VOA News, Juba, South Sudan.
From matters to do with education, we move to cybersecurity. Two Sudanese nationals are facing charges for running a guerrilla computer hacking group called Anonymous Sudan. The group aimed to declare cyber war on the United States by targeting the Federal Bureau of Investigation, government agencies in Alabama, Microsoft, and X through series of attacks. That's according to the Justice Department. The group carried out more than 35,000 attacks, with 70 of them targeting the Los Angeles metro area. These actions resulted in more than $10 million in damages in the United States. As reported last week by the U.S. Attorney General Office for the Central District of California, Ahmed Salah Yusuf Omar and Alaa Salah Yusuf Omar have been charged with conspiracy and computer damage for their coordinated cyber attacks from 2023 to the present year. My colleague Paul Ndiho spoke to Jimmy Kinyonyi Balgonza, a data scientist and cybersecurity analyst, about the impact of the attacks.
From the IT security perspective, I would say there is no secure system on the planet. It's all about takes time and the motivation for someone to do so. So, like you talked about the Anonymous Sudan, the brothers who were arrested in Sudan for having caused mayhem within the U.S. government. And even there's some hospital in, I think it's in California, where they affected the services and a lot of people died because of not getting the emergency services. Back in Africa, for example, that is becoming more of a safe haven for hackers is because of the economic pressure on the youth. You will note that in Africa has the highest percentage of people under the age of around 30 in the youthful stages. And looking at it, vis-a-vis the level of unemployment, which is also very high, this alone puts them into a situation of engaging in hacking activities. The motivation, because first of all, is the entry point into the hacking field or this cybercrime field is very, very low, the cost, if I may say, because online, all these tools are available online. You can get them online, you can learn the basics of cybersecurity online and being able to exploit them.
Does it take special skills for you to be so good at this that you are able to break into a system?
It takes time to cultivate the expertise to do that. So these tools are available online, yes, but you have to learn how to use them. And there are many resources online, like I've said, YouTube, TikTok, and so on. But then also more the, those that are more sophisticated, where now people have to get them on the underworld world, the cyber underworld world. where you have to access through specialized tools to access the other world. People who trade in cyber tools. They're not in Sudan. They had also put their tool before they were arrested. It was also on the market underworld. And you find that on average, you'd see that buying a tool that will give you full access to a system or network, it is approximately around $300 in the cyber underworld world. So look at $300 vis-a-vis what you're going to reap out of it. So that is also another motivation. That's, like I said, the entry point into the cyber world.
What does it mean for somebody to hack into a system and, you know, take people's data? You are a cybersecurity analyst. This is your space. What does it take to do that?
From layman's understanding, hacking into something more or less like someone entering into a house that is locked. For the motivation, they vary depending on what they want. Some of them are more financial. Others are more of espionage motivated. For example, some of the groups are being hired, more like mercenaries for hire to do a certain activity by government or state agents to achieve their political agenda. Others are financial agenda.
That's Jimmy Kenrani Bagonza, a data scientist and cybersecurity analyst. He spoke to VOA's Paul Ndiho from the state of Maryland. You're listening to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. Coming up, hunger hits South Africa. Find out why after the break. You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from The Voice of America. Kenyan President William Ruto has nominated Professor Kithuri Kindiki to replace Rigathi Gachagua, but Gachagua got a relief after the court suspended his impeachment. Gachagua, who had been in a hospital, was discharged Sunday. He revealed at a news conference on Sunday that two assassination attempts had been made on his life. Political reporter Barack Oduor of the People Daily discusses the new developments with VOA's James Batty.
On Sunday, former Deputy President Rigathi Gachagua left hospital in Nairobi. He got discharged, but he had to address journalists at the hospital. For the first time since he got into office, he opened a lead on the frosty relationship between him and President William Ruto. The deputy president made serious allegations about two assassination attempts against his life. He also said that his security has been withdrawn, both at his residences in Nairobi and in the hub country. The deputy president also went further to say that should anything happen to him or any member of his family, then the blame should squarely lie on President William Ruto.
What happens now to the trial in the Senate, whether he should now officially be removed? Where are we?
As you can be aware that the deputy president, Rigathi Gachagua, ran to court to stop his impeachment by the Senate. His claim at the court is that the impeachment process was done unprocedurally, illegally, and unconstitutionally. He wants the court to reverse the decisions of the Senate to impeach him. So court decided to halt the process of having him impeached. The courts also say that the new selected deputy president, Professor Kithure Kindiki, should not be sworn in. Remember, the swearing in of Professor Kithure Kindiki was planned for Saturday, but it was stopped by the courts. We are expecting a serious legal battle between lawyers of the Senate and the legal counsels of the deputy president as from Tuesday.
So Kenya is celebrating Mashujaa Day. Can you tell us what exactly is it?
Yes, Kenya on Sunday was marking Mashujaa Day. Mashujaa is a Kiswahili word that means heroes, those people who are deemed to have fought for the liberation of Kenya as a country. Remember, Kenya got its independence in 1963 from the British.
That's political reporter Barak Oduor of the People Daily. He spoke to VOA's James Batty from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. The World Food Programme says almost 30 million people in Southern Africa are affected by the region's worst hunger crisis in decades. The United Nations agency blames a drought that has caused extensive crop failures. But as Darren Taylor reports, other experts say there are additional factors involved.
Five countries, Lesotho, Malawi, Namibia, Zambia, and Zimbabwe, have declared national disasters over the drought and hunger. Angola, Eswatini, Mozambique, and South Africa are also severely affected. World Food Programme spokesperson Thomson Phiri says millions of people in Southern Africa risk going hungry.
The United Nations World Food Programme is calling for urgent assistance to prevent a widespread drought triggered by the El Nino phenomenon from deepening into a full-scale humanitarian catastrophe. A historic drought, the worst food crisis yet, has devastated more than 27 million lives across the region. Some 21 million children in Southern Africa are malnourished.
Piri says the agency needs around $370 million to provide immediate help, but it's only received a fifth of that as humanitarian crises rage in other parts of the world, including the Democratic Republic of Congo, Gaza, Sudan, and Ukraine. Agricultural experts tell VOA even if good rains fall the rest of October and into November, crops will only be ready next March and April. Phiri says millions of children in Southern Africa are now lucky to get one meal a day. Alan Browdy heads Southern Africa Harvest, a non-profit group feeding people across the region.
The fact that so many of our children suffer this fate is really a crime against humanity as far as I'm concerned.
Despite the drought, he describes the current hunger and malnutrition as a man-made disaster.
The fundamental problem is that food is too expensive. Most of our people cannot afford to access nutritious food. And the root cause of that really is a lack of government intervention. They extricate themselves from any involvement in the food ecosystem. They let the market rule completely. Now, in the developing country, when you let the food market, the food ecosystem, rule completely, the powerful get more powerful and the weaker get weaker. And we saw the pictures of poor farmers.
Browdy acknowledges the drought's decimating crops, but he adds it's often not the dry conditions that destroy small farmers and their ability to produce food. Often, he says, it's the power of big retailers who control supply chains that favor large-scale farmers.
Now, the retailers are in business. They're interested in profit, and one can't blame them for that. That's the system. But one has to control that. One has to have price controls and other measures that ensure that the small farmer is empowered and that people are able to buy food that is affordable and nutritious food.
Browdy is one of many experts calling on regional leaders to work toward a pact that controls the prices of some protein-rich foods, including frozen chicken, eggs, beans, and peanut butter. In the absence of controls, say economists, food prices have risen sharply in many areas affected by the drought, increasing suffering. Authorities in Namibia and Zimbabwe are even killing wildlife, including elephants, to provide meat for hungry people. Many scientists say sub-Saharan Africa is one of the most vulnerable parts of the world to climate change, because it depends on rain-fed agriculture. Millions of African livelihoods depend on the climate, with poor countries unable to finance resilience measures. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
That's all from us this Monday, October 21st, 2024. I must say I'm glad to be back here after being away for 1 week and 2 days. We now leave you with Kledi Muzika and the song Maenguchuma, which means in my native language, I'm alone. We have been listening to Kledi Muzika and the song Maenguchuma. For more on our programs, visit www.voaafrica.com. I'm your host, John Tanza, on this live broadcast from Studio 14 here in Washington. On behalf of our producer, Kwame Ofori, and engineer, Rob Macklin, we wish you a lovely evening. Remember to join us tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Lead poisoning can cause a variety of harmful effects, but the dangers are far more serious to children. When young children are exposed to lead, it slows their brain development, harms their bodies, and can even kill them, said USAID Administrator Samantha Power. Despite the well-known dangers of lead poisoning, countries around the world still struggle with addressing these threats, she said.
Historically, the yearly global funding for tackling lead poisoning in developing countries has totaled less than $15 million. It is a tiny fraction of what is spent on diseases with similar health burdens.
This changed last month when the United States and more than 50 stakeholders launched the Partnership for a Lead-Free Future. The group of governments, philanthropies, and businesses committed more than $150 million with the goal of ending childhood lead poisoning in developing nations by 2040. U.S. participation in this partnership is part of the Thrive Strategy, a government-wide effort to address global threats to children, said USAID Assistant Deputy Administrator Dr. Bama Athreya.
It's so important because we know that 1 in 3 children worldwide have elevated levels of lead in their blood, and that affects their long-term cognitive development. But it is a problem we can do something about, and the kind of focused, holistic attention that the Thrive Strategy places on early childhood development has enabled us to think about problems like lead and come up with these really great, practical, and partnership-focused efforts to end the problems.
This partnership is crucial to the larger goal of the U.S. Thrive Strategy to protect childhood development at all levels, said Assistant Deputy Administrator Athreya.
The Thrive Strategy is a global strategy, and it's focused on advancing protection and care for children who are in adverse or vulnerable situations worldwide. What's really wonderful about this strategy is that it is a whole of U.S. government approach to children in need worldwide.
There is a widespread agreement that we have to protect those children who are most vulnerable in the world, said Assistant Deputy Administrator Athreya. The United States will continue working with partners to protect children and eliminate threats to childhood development.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.